This message comes from Capital One. Your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services backed by the strength of a top 10 commercial bank. Visit CapitalOne.com/commercial. Member FDIC.
Hi, I'm Andrew from Elkins Park, Pennsylvania. The Sound of Young America is an independent production supported by listeners like you and me. If you'd like to donate to support the show, visit MaximumFun.org and click on Donate.
Live on tape from my house in Los Angeles, I'm Jesse Thorne, and this is The Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org.
Radio sweetheart on the airways, it's the sound of young America. Maximum Fun. Maximum Fun. Maximum Fun.
It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. As you probably already know, a couple of weeks ago we were in Seattle for the Bumbershoot Music and Arts Festival. We had a really fantastic time, and over the next couple of weeks, we'll be rolling out some of the material we recorded live on stage there. In this podcast, it's comics artist Adrian Tomina. His critically acclaimed series Optic Nerve is known for its clean, beautiful art and for its affecting portraits of young people's relationships and alienations. Last year, Tomina released the book-length story, Shortcomings. It was one of the first pieces of his work to address his identity as a Japanese-American. Let's go to the stage of Bumbershoot and my conversation with Adrian Tomina. Welcome to the show, Adrian.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here. One of the things that I was really interested in Shortcomings, and I thought was about as good a place to start as any, was the fact that you've recreated places in the book very directly, very literally. Mm-hmm. I'm from the Bay Area, lived there many years, and I recognized places in the book. Why did you make that choice?
Because I'm too lazy to be imaginative and, you know, invent things. I mean, that's the honest answer, really. I'm trying to create a realistic, you know, setting for the story. And when I was writing the book, it was actually easier for me to come up with the dialogue and everything if I was envisioning it in a place that I was familiar with. And so when it came to actually draw it, I would just, you know, go to those locations and sort of, and it's sort of like shooting on location or something like that. It had some sort of personal resonance to me and maybe for people who lived in those towns.
There's this kind of this expectation in the kind of comics that you write, of autobiographicalness, even in fiction comics. Mm-hmm. How did you relate to that expectation with this book?
Well, when I've been going out and talking about this book, one of the first questions that comes up is just like, how much of that is autobiographical? And mostly people are trying to judge me based on how much I'm similar to the characters that they disliked or something. But, you know, and then my gut reaction is to always be indignant and be like, why do you assume that it's autobiographical? But I think I was, you know, on some level trying to set myself up for that. I made the main character look a little bit like me and placed it in a lot of these locations where I'd lived. And I guess I was just sort of trying to play around. I mean, it is a totally fictional story and the characters are basically invented, but I was trying to... I don't know, maybe I wasn't trying to trick people, but I wanted there to be some sort of confusion between the reality and the fiction.
Why did you want that?
Well, I think it was because since I started working in a public way, there's always been that sort of interpretation of my work. People always just assume that the stories are strictly autobiographical. And I was trying to push myself past this problem that I saw in my work of trying to do work that would make an audience like me as a person rather than just create an interesting story. And so I thought a good way to try and break out of that was to do something where people might think it is me and actually hate me as a result, you know. It helps to get married, I gotta say, because then sort of like, you know, what do I care?
you started publishing this kind of comic generally at 15, right, if I'm remembering
right.
Correctly. That's pretty early to be off of superheroes and whatnot.
Might be a little late, actually. I mean, it depends on what your standard is. I mean,
yeah, well, comic book guys.
Yeah.
What was it? What drew you to that other side of comic books at that? As you were entering adolescence.
I think I just hit that point where I started to realize that I'd turned into just a collector and not a reader, that I was like robotically going to the store, like in this pathetic weekly ritual, and buying like the latest issue of whatever superhero comic, and then just not even having any interest in actually reading it, but just alphabetically filing it away in Mylar and all that. And then, you know, at a certain point I realized the absurdity of that situation and just, you know, started looking around. And, I think nowadays it's probably almost easier to find what I considered the good or, you know, alternative material, because that's become more mainstream. You know, you walk into a bookstore and there it is. But at that time it was like I had to sort of turn the corner and walk into the pornography section of the comic store and, you know, find one issue of, Weirdo or something like that.
Did you have an affinity for the form early on as a creator? Like, was drawing something that you always wanted to do or always did?
Yeah, I mean, I had the weird fantasy of working at Marvel Comics or something like that. There was some like weird imagined social aspect of it that appealed to me, that I thought like I would come into the office and we'd all have our drawing boards lined up and we'd, you know, be chatting while we worked or something. I was actually making kind of like fake comics before I could actually write. You know, a lot of cartoonists talk about this, where they were just sort of knowing what a comic should look like, but not actually having the brain power to write words. So they would put in little scribbles in the word balloons, you know. And
there's this, it's funny that you brought up that kind of social connection fantasy of yeah, comic books. It feels like for a lot of comics creators, especially people who work solo, they have partly in their mind when they start an idea of using this as a tool to make social connections. Was that the case for you?
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about, trying to break free of in my work, because even if you don't want to admit it to yourself at the time, at least for me, there was, you know, I was in high school and then college, and I was thinking like, well, I might not be able to like go out to these parties and actually meet girls, but maybe someone will see this comic and think I'm...
Did it work?
No. Of course not. Just don't waste your time, you know.
We'll have more with comics artist Adrian Tomina in just a minute. It's The Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org.
Production of The Sound of Young America is supported in part by Ask Metafilter. Thousands of life's little questions answered. Online at ask.metafilter.com.
MaximumFun.org is proud to present Max FunCon, a weekend of awesome. Join me, John Hodgman, Jonathan Colton, Jimmy Pardo, Maria Bamford, Hardin Firm, Tig Notaro, Jordan Morris, Merlin Mann, You Look Nice Today, Mark Frauenfelder, Jenny Jardin, and many more for a weekend of good times and being awesome in the mountains of Southern California. Comedy shows, seminars, classes, podcasts, and even s'mores await you. There's only 100 slots, and they're already more than half full, so visit MaxFunCon.com right now to register. Now, let's get back to the stage of The Sound of Young America live at Bumbershoot. It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest, Adrian Tomina, is a comics artist. His most recent book is Shortcomings. We were talking about Berkeley, and I'm from San Francisco, and you know, you went to UC Berkeley. I went to UC Santa Cruz, so we're pretty much on the same page in this department. But Berkeley is a place that is completely obsessed with identity politics.
Yeah.
And that was a topic that in some ways, particularly in terms of ethnic identity politics, you actively avoided in your work for a long time.
Yeah.
Let's start first with why did you avoid issues of race for a long time?
It's like there was probably just a slight rebellious streak in me, because I just the way I grew up and the cities that I lived in, that was never really at the forefront of my consciousness. And then I started publishing comics, and every journalist I met, you'd get a few perfunctory questions out of the way, and they'd be like, now why aren't you addressing your racial identity in your work? And I think there was some part of me that was just sort of put off by that expectation. And so, since that seemed to be what everybody wanted, I decided not to do it. That's just, you know, that's the way I work, I guess. So I think I just really resisted it for a long time. But at the same time, I was actually accumulating ideas. It's not like I just ruled it out completely and never paid it any mind. So I was accumulating ideas of ways I could eventually get into that subject matter without feeling like I was really betraying the other work that I had done.
In the opening scene of Shortcomings, the protagonist, Ben, is having an argument with his serious girlfriend who is working on an Asian American film festival. They go to see a film that he hates, and he kind of feels like she thinks he should like it because it's an Asian American film. And he disagrees strongly. And I thought that was a hilarious way of kind of throwing down the gauntlet in the first scene of this kind of you wanting to address this in a different way.
Yeah, I got asked recently to come speak at some Asian American film festival, and I was like, this is a trap. I know this is like their chance for revenge or something.
But like when you were listing your ideas for listing these ideas, keeping when you had this list in your back pocket of ways that you wanted to address identity issues, what were the things that you wanted and the things that you didn't want?
I didn't want anything that was going to uplift or affirm people's pre-existing beliefs. I mean, I figured this isn't a book for kids, and so I figured anyone who's coming to it probably already has their political beliefs all squared away themselves, or they're figuring it out on their own. And, you know, I'm probably the last person to try and advise anyone in that regard. So I feel like that's the main pitfall of that. A lot of that material is that it gets up on a soapbox and pronounces some really obvious platitude that everyone in the room agrees with. And so I just figured I didn't, you know, drawing comics is pretty slow and arduous. So why waste the time doing something like that?
At the same time, you have this protagonist with very contrary views on this issue. And he also has some, you know, contradictions within himself about dealing with it. And one would, as you mentioned, like to see this as the voice of the authorial voice coming through, except that it's also very clear in this book that the protagonist is kind of an unpleasant jerk in a lot of ways, which is especially for your first kind of full-length, novel-length, 100-page operation, is a pretty bold choice to make.
Yeah, I mean, it was a little bit by accident because I don't think I intended him to be so disagreeable, I guess. I think I'm just a little bit out of sync with other people's standards, because I thought it could be, you know, questionable, but not the litany of criticism. You know, I never expected that. So that was the first surprise that I got when the material started going out there was, I think if you do a Google search and type in the character's name, comma, you know, all these searches come up, because there's all these reviews that just start off with, like, Ben Tanaka is a or he's, you know, whatever the word. You know, there's a lot of people that's just their whole reaction to the book is how much they hate the character. And so as a result, when I have to go out and face the public, there's a lot of times where someone will stand up and their question is to, like, quote some specific line if it's from the book and say, do you agree or disagree? You know, it's like, and then they're going to judge me based on that.
You mentioned everyone having their own ideas about things. Were you surprised by reactions that you got? Were there people who responded to this work in ways that you weren't expecting?
Yeah, I'd say I was, you know, anything that goes into either extreme is a little bit of a surprise for me. So the fact that some people would actually stand in line at signings to basically, you know, trash me and express their dislike of the book.
But Adrian, I don't mean to cut you off. You have been publishing hate mail.
That's true.
In the back of your comic every month.
That's true.
You've started creating it.
I think I've sort of invited it somehow, because I think now people think that's the way to get my letter printed, is to just really, you know, rip them to shreds. So I can't complain.
How did you, I wanted to ask you, how did you get the idea that your Dear Stan Lee column wouldn't be, you know, in issue 324, Spider-Man wore a red hat instead of a blue hat, but instead would be about half complimentary letters and about half people really ripping you a new one?
Yeah, because that was the mail I was getting, and I thought, you know, it would be so dishonest if I just edited out all the bad stuff and just made it look like everybody loved everything I did. And, you know, I did it for the first issue, and the general consensus amongst people who read it was that letters column was the best thing about the whole comic. You know, so I was like, I guess they like seeing that. So I've sort of stuck with that.
Well, what was the greatest difficulty of going from writing these very short stories to writing a book length piece with the objective of actually writing a book length piece?
Yeah, I had to figure out how to actually write something like a plot for after, you know, I've managed to coast by for 10 years without ever having to do that. And so that was probably the biggest challenge, was to actually try and conceive of something that was bigger than what I could, you know, accommodate in my brain at one moment. You know, a lot of those short stories were never actually written in any formal way until I started drawing the comic, because I could just visualize it in my head. But, you know, when you start talking about 90, 100 pages, and knowing that you got to achieve certain things at certain points along the way, it involved a level of planning that was new to me.
There's such a deep level of planning in writing a comic, because it's both solitary and incredibly labor intensive.
Right.
Did you have fear that when you started in to make something that was full length, so to speak, that you would get in, you know, a third of the way and not be happy with it, but you already spent 2 years doing storyboards or whatever?
It's like, I've literally had nightmares about that, you know, just the idea of like saying, I'm going to do a 1,000-page graphic novel about the history of, you know, something, and, you know, halfway through deciding I have no interest in the subject matter. So that was why I was fairly unambitious with this book. I was going to write about, you know, things that were...
All you were going to tackle was the race politics issues that you hadn't handled for the last 10 years.
Exactly. I had a lot of ideas saved up in my head. So, and it didn't involve any real research other than living my life.
Well, Adrian, thank you so much for taking the time to be on
The
Young America. It was such a pleasure to have you. Adrian Tomina.
Thank you very much.
Adrian Tomina is the creator of the comic Optic Nerve. His most recent book-length piece is called Shortcomings. That's our time for another Sound of Young America podcast. I've been your host, Jesse Thorne, America's radio sweetheart. The show produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our theme music written and performed by Dan Grayson with help from myself. Interstitial music provided by Dan Wally. Special thanks this week to Nick White, who directed and produced our live shows at Bumbershoot. He also edited the show. You can find us online at MaximumFun.org, and I do hope you'll check out MaxFunCon.com and think about coming and joining us in the mountains of Southern California for a weekend of awesome. By the way, if you happen to be in Seattle and maybe you missed us at Bumbershoot, or you came and you had a good time, we'll be back in Seattle at the Seattle Sketchfest with guest Dan Savage and more. You can find more information at sketchfest.org. We'll see you next time on The Sound of Young America.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Vuori, a new perspective on performance apparel. Clothing designed with premium fabrics, built to move in, styled for life. For 20% off your first purchase, go to Vuori.com/NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from IXL Online. Is your child asking questions on their homework you don't feel equipped to answer? IXL Learning uses advanced algorithms to give the right help to each kid, no matter the age or personality. One subscription gets you everything. One site for all the kids in your home, pre-K to 12th grade. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And NPR listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/NPR.
Spend time in any American city, and you'll likely encounter someone with untreated psychosis. Lost Patients is a new podcast examining our maze-like system for treating severe mental illness, which loses patients to an endless loop between the streets, jail, and hospitals. Does it have to be this way? For the history, the reality, and hopefully some solutions, listen to Lost Patients from KUOW and the Seattle Times, part of the NPR network.